So I call this talk Tools for Answering Tough Questions, and the box of tools has arrived, or at least some of the tools. Actually, one of the points I'll be making is that there are all kinds of different tough questions, and there's no single answer to the question how to deal with a tough question. So I thought I would start us off by throwing some questions out there and letting you mull them for a minute and tell me what you think, and then I will bring in some information, sometimes from recent scholarship, because sometimes you need recent scholarship, sometimes from old books, and by old books I mean things that were printed before George Washington was born, which are addressing the very same questions that you'll get hit with if you go out and surf the web. There are some times when I think that Ecclesiastes has got it dead right. There's nothing new under the sun. And controversies that were happening back in the 1700s are absolutely controversies that we need to be studying. For which purpose? Time out for a brief advertisement. This summer, I'll be teaching an online course. It's graduate level, but if you're a sharp undergraduate, we can probably get you into it. It's going to be on what's called the deist controversy. This was a period in English history from the late 1600s to the mid-1700s when the fashionable way to attack Christianity was to say, Christianity has part of the story right. There's a God. God created the universe. You can tell God's power from creation. However, all of this revealed stuff, all this stuff about Jesus coming to earth, about God having something to do with the children of Israel, all of this stuff about prophecy, that's got to go. None of that works. And the arguments with which they attack that are very much the arguments that you will still hear today. Oh, there are some updates in the arguments in the atheist and agnostic arsenal, but those are mostly on the science front. And it's only fair, if they're going to attack Christianity with modern science, that the theists be allowed to use modern science to shoot back. So, aside from that, the criticisms of Scripture, 97-98% of what you will find in new books, modern attacks on Christianity, is a repetition of stuff that was done in the old books. And the great thing is, you discover as you read some of these old books that people thought in very careful, sensible ways. You might have thought of a certain response and said, wow, that seems really compelling to me, but I wonder if I'm the only person who ever thought that. Tom just had an experience like that. Tom's been developing a line of argument, and I sent him a book from, what is it, 1900, Tom?
The one you sent me was from 1900.
Yeah.
Right.
And Tom began to wonder if somebody had invented time travel, right? Maybe the author was a time lord and just stepped into the phone booth and went back a century or so. But thinking incredibly paralleling some things that Tom has been quite independently developing. There's
my talk tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm not going to, I won't be second, I'm not stealing any thunder more than that. I just wanted to say, and old books. Okay. So, there's a great line in the movie Shadowlands. It's not actually a line found, as far as I know, in C.S. Lewis's writings, but it's a terrific line anyway. The line is, we read to know that we are not alone. And I have found that very, very, very true. Let's start with a couple of questions here. I go online to an infidel website, and somebody is throwing Deuteronomy 22 in my face and saying, wow, the Old Testament is a bad book. Look at this, Deuteronomy 22, 28 and 29. Laws concerning sexual immorality. If a man meets a virgin who is not her betrothed and seizes her and lies with her and they are found, then the man who lay with her shall give the father of the young woman 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife because he has violated her. He may not divorce her all his days. So, what's the spin that you're going to hear about that one? How's that one going to be put as a challenge to you? God condones rape. In fact, if a girl is raped, she has to marry the rapist.
She's bought, and then she has to.
Oh, she's been even better. She's sold to her rapist. Doesn't that sound great? What is wrong with you Christians? So what do you say? Kind of duck your head, mumble a little bit like, that was the Old Testament. Yeah, it's the Old Testament. You guys are supposed to believe that too, right? And this isn't just a description of something that did happen. If it was just a description of something that happened, you could write it off. You could say, hey, you know, some things happened that are not normative. They're not the way it's supposed to be. It's okay if things happen and God doesn't have to condone them to say that they did happen. There's lots of stuff we can think of, all kinds of examples of that. But this one's in the law. So, what do you do with that?
Well, you think about the principle. I think the principle is sexual responsibility.
Sure, there's a principle of sexual responsibility, and that's a fair thought to have. But still, the objection comes back at you. All right. Selling her to a rapist. What in the world? How could you condone that? Maybe you kind of think, well, you know, there are some things that are different in different cultures. And actually, there's part of the answer in there somewhere. But unless you could put a cutting edge on it, it doesn't sound very good just to say, oh, something vague about other cultures. Next question. That's not a really helpful response, is it? What's the reference that I just quoted from? Oh, good. Deuteronomy 22. You guys were listening. What does the name Deuteronomy mean? What is that name of that book? What does that mean? It's composed of two words, Deuteros, Nomos. What is that? Second law. A second telling of the law. A recapitulation. In fact, a summary. Well, if that's the second, and it's a summary, where's the original of which it is the summary?
Exodus.
It's in Exodus. You're right. What chapter? Oh,
give me a second.
Google will help. It's in Exodus 22. Flip back. Let's go back to Exodus 22, 16 and 17. It's very important to do this, especially with things out of Deuteronomy, because it is a compressed retelling, a digest of the law, not the full statement of it. Let's go back and see what it says here. 22:16. If a man seduces a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall give the bride price for her and make her his wife. But what follows? If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the bride price for virgins. Now, that's a little different, isn't it? There's a way in there, there's a clause in there for it to just be the case that the family says no. In the person of the father, this is where culture comes in. It would be the patriarch who would make that decision. The father would say, that doesn't mean that he wouldn't consult his daughter's wishes, but if the man's a ne'er-do-well, he can just say no. What would be the implications of his saying no? Now he's got a daughter who's been raped. She is therefore no longer a virgin. He might be able to marry her off, but at this point, she's damaged goods. Culturally speaking, she's a reduced value commodity. What makes up for that reduced value? She just got the full price of her bride price. And so with that, she has now some actual wealth, some actual property. There's another bit to this, though. In that retelling of the law in Deuteronomy 22, what's the very last phrase there? End of verse 29. He may not divorce her all his days. To us, That just sounds a little odd. It doesn't have any deep cultural significance. But what is the significance of saying in the ancient Near East that a man has a wife and he cannot get rid of her?
She's taken care of.
He has to support her for all of her life. She's set. She's taken care of. If it's a guy that she's willing to marry, her dad's willing to give her to the guy, then she can't be booted out. She can't be sent out like Hagar is sent out into the wilderness. She can't be got rid of. That's a very significant constraint. And it's something, honestly enough, that would make a man think twice. How many of you have seen the musical Seven Brides for Seven Brothers? Yeah, a couple of you have seen that. What happens at the end? The seven brothers have grabbed some girls from the town and they've run away with them, and an avalanche has come down and closed the pass. In the springtime, they're all up there. And what happens? There's a shotgun wedding. All the fathers are standing there with their shotguns pointed at the heads of the guys as they're saying, "I do," right? "You're going to marry this girl now, whether you want it or not." Well, that's the law. It's actually much more friendly to the concerns of the young woman than it looks like at first blush when you read it. That answer, you don't have to get out of an old book. That answer involves knowing something about the structure of the Old Testament, knowing that Deuteronomy is a retelling of the law, knowing that it's not simply a statement of what the law is, but a recapitulation, knowing that you should go somewhere else to look for a cross-reference. Lots of passages are like that. You should always not only read the context, but in a different sense, think about the context. Think about the ancient Near Eastern context and what kind of a difference that would make to it. So that was the first tough question I wanted to throw out there, just because I actually got involved in a debate some years ago on a friend's website with an atheist who brought this up quite triumphantly. Like, I've got the killer, you guys. A raped woman has to marry her rapist. And we answered him. And he tried to squirm a little bit. And we shot his squirming attempts down. And he finally very grumpily conceded, "Yeah, all right, you're right." And so my friend Matt and I said to him, "All right, so you're going to stop using this argument?" And he said, "Well, I didn't know I'd wandered into a den of a bunch of PhDs here." No, we said, "Well, that's not the issue. Are you going to stop using the argument?" "No," he said. "I'll just go somewhere else." With enemies like that, you almost don't need friends. Really? You're that blatantly dishonest? Wow, I'm glad you're not on our team. That's amazing. I mean, you know, God bless, I wish you a change of heart, but in the meantime, stay away! That's amazed me. I was more astonished by that than I was by anything else that he said. I'm going to keep on using this argument. Because not everybody's a PhD, not everybody knows this. Wow. You have any questions about that one? That was just a sort of an icebreaker to get things started.
Only thing would be just the word differences from the English translation. One says rape, one says seduces.
Yeah, very few of us, and I'm not one of them, are good enough Hebrew scholars to be able to make fine distinctions like that, right? I can read enough biblical languages to use any commentary I need to, and beyond that, I'm lexicon man. I'm looking it up. Yeah. So, I would say, it would be great to have that facility. Some of you are in. How many seminary students we got here? Awesome. Do your Greek and your Hebrew. And keep them up. Once you've done them, make some kind of a pledge to yourself. I'm going to read this language for 5 minutes every day. 5 minutes a day, that'll keep you going. I wish I had done that. Now, I have an uphill climb to get this back. There are even books out here you can buy, like Forgotten Greek. I have a lot of that. My dad was a Greek professor. I grew up singing the Greek alphabet to the tune of 10 Little Indians. If I weren't losing my voice, I would do it for you now, and the room would be half empty by the time I'm done. But, yeah, keep those up. A book came out about a year and a half ago. The author's name is Candida Moss. She's a professor at the University of Notre Dame. The title of her book is The Myth of Christian Persecution. And she has degrees from places like Oxford. So let me ask you a question. What would you say to somebody who says, yeah, you guys always claim the early Christians were persecuted, but they weren't really persecuted? And you stop and you try to remember the name of some guy who you think there was a story about that he was like burned at the stake or something, and nothing comes. You'd like to be able to access Google, but your smartphone isn't working and the internet connection is not behaving. And what do you say? Do you just sort of say, well, okay, maybe it was a myth. Maybe the early Christians were not persecuted. I'll give that one up. There's a line of argument you can use. It lies not only within your grasp, but within your knowledge. Every one of you has seen this. But I'm guessing that you're not recognizing it because there's an obvious sounding response to it. It's in an old book. I mean, what isn't? So, somebody look up Matthew 24:9. Somebody else, look up Mark 4:17. Somebody else, look up Luke 21:12. Somebody else try John 16:2. Somebody raise a hand if you got the Matthew passage already. In the back, go for it.
Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake.
All right, so who's speaking? Who's speaking in the Jesus passage? Jesus is speaking, and he's saying, they'll deliver you up to persecution or tribulation or affliction and kill you, and you'll be hated of all nations for my name's sake. Okay, how about Mark? Who's got that? Go for it.
But since they have no root, they last only a short time. When trouble or persecution comes because of the word, they quickly fall away.
Right, so this is from Jesus' parable about the man who casts seed on various kinds of ground, right? This falls on, what is it, the stony ground? And it'll start to grow up a little bit, but then it doesn't have a deep root. Soon as trouble or persecution arises, it withers away. How about Luke? Luke 21. Yeah.
But before all this, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons, and you will be brought before kings and governors for my name's sake.
Okay, very explicit about how they're going to persecute them, lay hands on them, bring them from to judgment. How about John 16?
They will ban you from the synagogues. In fact, the time is coming when anyone who kills you will think he is offering service to God.
Okay, so from all four Gospels, explicit statements of Jesus about persecution. In the one case in Mark, clearly indicating this is the kind of thing you can expect to have coming. In the other Gospels, actually saying absolutely outright, it's going to come. This is so great. I got a room full of Baptists, and there are people in the front row. Awesome. I love it.
Back rows.
Yeah, right.
I did notice that the back two rows were completely filled. The back three rows are almost filled. All right. So Jesus seems to have said this a lot. What's the obvious problem that comes to mind with responding to somebody who says, yeah, you Christians say that, you know, they were persecuted, but you don't really have any reason for that? You say, well, you know, look at all these words of Jesus, what's the obvious skeptical response?
Circular reasoning.
Circular reasoning. Why?
Because we're referring to a book that can't be authenticated in their
right. They're not going to trust the book. So why should they believe that Jesus said these things at all? Obvious response. Everybody thought of that, right? Let me show you a bit of Judah. Let's not assume that Jesus actually said these things. Let's back up for a minute. Still, we have these books. And in these books, it is said that Jesus said these things. What explains that fact? That the books do claim that. One of two things. Either Jesus did say them and they conformed to the way that events eventually fell out and so they were written down, or he didn't say them but the words are in there anyway. Why would you put words like that into Jesus' mouth if he hadn't said them? Assume that you don't have moral scruples about this. Why would you do that? Because it happened. And you want to make him look like a prophet. Right? You don't have to assume for the sake of this argument that Jesus actually said these things. Do not misunderstand me. I am not giving any credibility to the claim that Jesus didn't utter these claims. Okay? I'm solidly on board with the fact that he did. But you don't need that to make this argument. Because the idea that Jesus never said this and it didn't happen, but people who obviously revered Jesus put them into his mouth so he'd look like an idiot, doesn't fly. You see how that works?
Tim?
Yeah.
Here's another Judah move you can make, if I may.
Go.
Matthew 5:11. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you. Because of me.
Yeah.
Persecution apparently in Jesus' mind included insulting, saying all kinds of evil against us. So if you say Christians have never been persecuted and you're mocking me for thinking we've been persecuted, what's going on right now?
Yeah, that looks like Jesus got out in front of that one too, didn't
yes.
he? So here, let me just read you from William Paley's View of the Evidences of Christianity, first published in 1794. He quotes all of those passages that we just read, and then he says, I am not entitled to argue from these passages that Christ actually did foretell these events, and that they did accordingly come to pass, because that would be at once to assume the truth of the religion. But I am entitled to contend that one side or other of the following disjunction is true. Either that the evangelists have delivered what Christ really spoke and that the event corresponded with the prediction, or that they put the prediction into Christ's mouth because at the time of writing the history, the event had turned out so to be. Well, yes. Older writers faced challenges of the kinds we face, and sometimes they thought them through very well indeed. There's more, though. He goes on. That's not the end of his argument. He says, look, the epistles abound with exhortations to patience, comfort under distress. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword? Nay, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. That's Romans 8. How baffling would that be to the Roman audience if they were well-fed, happy, prosperous, well-liked in the community, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril. So what? What? And let me tell you, in less than a decade after Paul wrote that, the church in Rome knew full well what persecution and sword meant. Because in August of the year 64 AD, the slums in Rome caught fire. Not only did they catch fire, but neighboring buildings caught fire, and a large portion of Rome was burned to the ground. Now, the Emperor Nero had been lobbying and fighting with the Senate and trying to get them to demolish those slums and rebuild some better dwellings there. And it was widely believed that Nero was behind the firing of the slums, that he had done the job, if not with his own hand, at least that he had put people up to it. He tried sacrificing to the Roman gods to appease them for this, and nobody really thought that that did much to take the attention off of him. When he realized that, he did what all good politicians do. He found a scapegoat. And the scapegoat he chose were a sect hated for their abominations, the Christians. Oh, did I mention that I have a Roman source for that? This would be Tacitus, the Roman historian, in his Annals, Book 15, Chapter 44. But neither these exertions, nor his largesses to the people, nor his offerings to the gods, did away the infamous imputation under which Nero lay, of having ordered the city to be set on fire. To put an end, therefore, to this report, he laid the guilt and inflicted the most cruel punishments upon a set of people who were holden in abhorrence for their crimes, and called, by the vulgar, Christians. The founder of that name was Christ, who suffered death in the reign of Tiberius under his procurator Pontius Pilate. This pernicious superstition, thus checked for a while, broke out again and spread not only over Judea, where the evil originated, but through Rome also, whither everything bad upon the earth finds its way and is practiced. Do you notice this is not a friendly witness? He's hostile to Christianity, but how many points is he making that are of value for us? Some who confessed their sect were first seized, and afterwards, by their information, meaning they tortured them to get them to name others, a vast multitude were apprehended who were convicted, not so much of the crime of burning Rome, as of hatred to mankind. Their sufferings at their execution were aggravated by insult and mockery, for some were disguised in the skins of wild beasts and worried to death by dogs. Some were crucified. Others were wrapped in pitched shirts and set on fire when the day closed, that they might serve as lights to illuminate the night. Nero lent his own gardens for these executions and exhibited at the same time a mock Circensian entertainment, being a spectator of the whole in the dress of a charioteer, sometimes mingling with the crowd on foot, sometimes viewing the spectacle from his car. This conduct made the sufferers pitied. And though they were criminals and deserving the severest punishments, yet they were considered and sacrificed not so much out of a regard to the public good as to gratify the cruelty of one man. Oh, I'm reading this out of a book that was published in 1794. They knew about these things, you see. Tacitus was born about the year 57. He's born about the time that Paul is writing some of his larger epistles, Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians. That means he was 7 or 8 years old when the fire broke out. 10 years later, he was a student in Rome, which means he had to have lots of opportunity to talk to a whole lot of people who had been there at the time this had happened. So his testimony is not just the testimony of somebody who might have read about it somewhere vaguely. This is the testimony of somebody who lived in Rome within a decade of the time these events happened. As a young man, fully aware, and he probably heard a cross-section of opinion. Some people probably said, oh, they were terrible people. They did abominations. What kind of abominations would the Christians be accused of?
Eating and drinking flesh.
Right. That thing that Jesus said in John 6 that caused people to say, whoa, that's a little too intense for me. I think I'm going away, right? Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood. Wow. Now, it's not hard to see how the Romans would view this little detached sort of Jewish splinter group, and rumors would fly around about what these people did. If you think rumors like that wouldn't spread, look into what's called the blood libel, which has lots of currency in Arab countries about how the Jews make their matzos. Check it out. This is in films being made and shown in Pakistan in the 21st century. Ugly rumors about groups that you don't much like spread really fast, and they're very hard to eradicate. And yet, at the end, even Tacitus, who was not only a Roman governor, but also, as one often was when a Roman governor in those days, a priest who officiated at the rites for the official Roman cult of the worship of the emperor as a god, even he, an unfriendly witness, has some remaining bit of pity that's wrung out of his heart by all of this. But back to the New Testament. We're not done. This is an argument we're going to beat into the ground. All of these things in Romans or in 1 Corinthians. Oh, where's the passage? Oh, no, sorry, 2 Corinthians 4, 8 through 10. We are troubled on every side, yet not distressed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Cast down, but not destroyed. Always bearing about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life also of Jesus might be made manifest in our body, knowing that he which raised up the Lord Jesus shall raise us up also by Jesus. For which cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. For our light affliction, I'm going over to 14 through 17 if you're wondering what happened there.
Yeah.
Our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. Or try James 5, verse 10 and following, or Hebrews 10, 32 and following. With Romans and 2 Corinthians, there's absolutely no doubt that these were epistles of Paul. Even Bart Ehrman accepts that. Though I think he'd find a way around it if he could. What could such exhortations to patience and endurance under suffering mean to the recipients of those letters if there was no persecution? It's not couched hypothetically. If it were someday to happen that you might suffer some persecution, then you should be like this. It's very directly written to comfort those who are enduring this right at this time. And then, if we wanted direct assertions, just go to the book of Acts and start reading. But do you see how the ground for that is prepared? Right? Somebody might say the book of Acts, well, maybe that's just things that they made up way later. Well, no, for lots of reasons, but these are several lines of response to this criticism. So where does that get us? Yes, the early Christians suffered persecution. Maybe not always official, maybe not always empire-wide, but steady and distressing and troubling, probably ebbing and flowing. Don't tell me that when Nero put out the word that the Christians were guilty of this, don't tell me that off in Asia Minor nothing happened. Official word like that goes out, and it's open season. Yep. For how long? We don't know. But coming up again and again and again, when Pliny, the governor of Bithynia, writes about the year 112, 113 to the Emperor Trajan, he says, you know, this Christianity thing has sprung up, and our temples are being emptied. We're not getting the revenue from the temples. It's a problem. It's a problem in the cities. It's a problem out in the countryside. So somebody told me sort of unofficially and off the record that certain people were Christians. So I brought them in and I examined them, and I tortured some deaconesses, and all I could find out was that it's some kind of crazy superstition that they worship Jesus as a god, and they meet and they sing songs to him, and then they take an oath not to do evil to anyone, and then they come back together and they eat a meal together. What should I do with these people? Oh, I killed a couple of them because they kept on saying they were Christians, and that was just too obstinate for me. This is going to sound funny. On the whole, Pliny was not a bad guy. By Roman standards, he was by no means the worst of the governors. And yet he could casually write to the emperor and say, not really sure what's to be done about this. I did kill a few of them. What do you want me to do? That's the world that arose out of the first generation of Christians. There you're on to the second or third generation. But that was the norm. That's the way these things were handled. So much for the myth of Christian persecution. Maybe we should call it the myth of the myth of Christian persecution. Here's an easier one. Let's try this one. Answer is also in our books. Well, can't we explain the rise of Christianity just the way that we explain the rise of other religions? We explain the rise of Islam. That's not hard, right? You get these people, they fanatically believe in this religious message. There's a holy book. It's come down to them. They take that as their holy book. They're very devout. Yeah, no wonder. Islam exploded. So did Christianity. Why don't we just say, we can explain all these things in the same way. People believe weird things. Sometimes it catches on. Why do we need your whole story about miracles and a resurrection and all that stuff to make it work? Besides, other religions have their miracles too. So why should yours be any different? Why do you make an exception for your religion but allow all these other religions just to sail right on through? How come? Double standard bunch of Christians? Have you heard that challenge? Yeah, some of you have. So what do you say?
We have evidence.
We have evidence. I agree. Unfortunately, often at that point in a conversation, the evidence that we have isn't something they're interested in looking at.
Sure.
I am what you would call a full-bore macho evidentialist. For me, it's all evidence all the time. Not everybody takes that perspective. Just saying it as a sort of a personal confession. When I had my doubts about Christianity, I was in high school and early college, I wanted to know, wow, you know, good people have taught me these things, but why should I believe that they're true? Nothing worked for me except evidence. I was given the works of a very famous presuppositionalist author. That was the closest I ever came to walking away from Christianity. That did not work for me. That really did sound like circular reasoning. In fact, he said so. That bothered me. I was on the point of going into a philosophy major and becoming a specialist in logic. Don't tell me that it's just circular reasoning, but that's okay. Don't say that. But how do we answer this challenge? Words to a golden old song say, don't know much about history. How much do we really know about the history of Islam? Actually, we know a lot about the history of Islam. Muhammad conceived his radical, simplified monotheism and wrote his surahs of the Quran and set out in a diplomatic sort of way to try to convert people by presenting his ideas. How much success did he have?
true now.
For 10 years, he was there peacefully persuading people by reason. He made roughly one convert a month, most of them members of his own extended family. After 10 years, he had about 100 people to show for it. And if he had continued that way, most of us would never have heard of Islam today. But then he had a better idea. It's an idea for founding a religion, and it's very similar to the idea that Joseph Smith got, maybe inspired a little bit by Muhammad. And it's this: take a double dose of testosterone and shake hard. Plunder and sex. Let's go on the warpath, guys. And that worked really well. Suddenly, he was making tons of converts, and then they were swelling the ranks of his army. He had one military victory, won by some daring on his part. Give him credit where it's due. But after that, his ranks swelled, and he swept through and took over as a warlord. I said there were parallels to Joseph Smith. Did you know that when Joseph Smith died, he was on the ballot running for president of the United States as General Joseph Smith? The Nauvoo Legions were the largest standing army outside of Washington, D.C. It was not just all peaceful dialogue. He was taking a leaf out of Muhammad's playbook. He knew how it's done. I had an atheist once dialoguing with me who said to me, "Yeah, you know, Christianity and Islam, they both spread. You can't say that yours is any different." And when I wrote back to him, I said, "Look, Christianity and Islam both flourished at the point of a sword. The difference was the direction the sword was pointing. And that makes all the difference." At the time, he didn't respond to that. But later, he became a Christian, dear Christian brother today. And he told me afterwards, "You know, that line of yours stuck in my head, and I couldn't get it out of my head, and it really bothered me because it was obvious you were right. And I didn't know what to do." Take heart from this. Sometimes you will say something, and you'll say, "This is a great answer. I'm giving this person this great answer." Crickets. You don't hear anything. It's okay. Give the good answers. And remember that even Paul said he would plant, somebody else would water. God's the one who would bring life to the dead. God's the one who would give the increase. Sometimes that's the way it works. And you don't know. And you may never know. He could have wandered out of my orbit and come to Christ somewhere where I never heard about it. And I wouldn't know. And that's okay. All of that's in Paley, by the way. Here's another one. Jesus' resurrection. Isn't it a little bit funny that Jesus never appeared to the chief priests and rulers? Wouldn't that have been an obvious way to establish his messiahship? "Okay, you guys, you're the rulers. By your instigation, I was crucified. Here I am. What you gonna say now?" Doesn't it look a little funny that he didn't do that? Almost looks like those Christians are making an excuse for the fact that only the people who were in the Jesus community actually saw him. Sound a little fishy to you? Have you heard that one? Come on, hands. Even Baptists can raise their hands to the shoulder height, right? Okay. So what do you say? Why didn't Jesus just appear to everybody? Heck, why didn't he appear to Pilate? That would have done it.
I think he stated very clearly that his kingdom is not of this world.
He did, absolutely. But then again, you're dealing with people so skeptical, they may come back at you and say, "Well, that's what some Christian said later he said. But why should I believe that either?" I mean, when it comes to being skeptical about the Gospels, these guys are really very skeptical. They're often not very skeptical about other things. I do sometimes say to skeptics, you know, skepticism is a great thing. doesn't have to be reserved just for Christianity and the Bible. Try doubting something else. I stole that line from C.S. Lewis. Two questions. First of all, what was the reaction that we're told about? What's the story? For the moment, we can just consider it as something someone said in John 11 with the resurrection of Lazarus. What was the reaction to the resurrection of Lazarus? As we're told it. Got it. You already skipped forward into chapter 12 and picked it out on me. The Jewish leaders did not say, wow, all right, maybe we were just wrong about this guy. He's notably raised someone from the dead. There's no denying it. We'd better get on board with him. No. John 12, which follows John 11, naturally enough. After Mary anoints Jesus at Bethany, go down to verse 9 and 10. When a large crowd of Jews learned that Jesus was there, they came not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to put Lazarus to death as well, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and believing in Jesus. Wait. You were dead. Now you're alive. Oh, I got a great idea. We'll make you dead again, and this time we'll make it stick. How do you get inside the mindset of someone who can respond to a miracle like that? You say, that's too fanciful. I can't believe anybody could be that stupid. I can't believe anybody could really be that blinded by their religious prejudices that they would do that. Really? Can you not think of any large religious group today that boasts fanatical followers who would actually just try to plow something like that under, even in the face of evidence that they had to know showed it was true? Jewish archaeologists can't go to Temple Mount today and dig because there's a mosque over top of the site. They're doing a lot of excavating and digging under that mosque, where we might reasonably expect to find some priceless artifacts. They're carrying it out in bulldozers and dumping it. Archaeologists occasionally get to sift through the rubble and find broken fragments of things that would have been priceless if they were more intact. Several of the things that they've found there show pretty clearly the existence of the Davidic kingdom in Israel. Evidence of it, material evidence of it right there. But since they deny that there ever was such a Jewish kingdom there, they're systematically destroying the evidence. How does that compute? You mean they're finding things that they know are evidence and then they're destroying them so that there won't be the evidence? Why, who would do a thing like that? That would be as crazy as trying to kill a man who'd been raised from the dead. Yeah, just about. Human nature is a funny thing. We can get our a priori ideas about what people will do and won't do, and then we go out and we actually look and see. And it's pretty astonishing. But we can do more than that. Let's suppose, I'm going to pull out another old book. This one's from 1729. Not this printing, of course. I printed this out for myself. But the book is from 1729. Let's suppose that they had done it, that Jesus had done it. Jesus had appeared to the chief priests and persuaded them. In fact, what if he had persuaded the entire Jewish nation that he was indeed their Messiah? Then what? What happens next? Why, persuaded and convinced that their Messiah is indeed come, the Jews go fanning out all across the empire, up into Parthia, out into Arab Perea, and they proclaim the news, our Messiah has come. And what's the obvious skeptical rejoinder from a sardonic Roman philosopher? What's he going to say?
It could have been as a made-up story.
Yeah, this is a ploy by the Jewish nation. They're not in a position of much power and authority right now. They're trying to up their position by making up some crazy story. And they're doing it as an entire nation, right? With the resources of the entire Jewish leadership behind it, you could easily produce a story like that. If the leaders were behind it, that could have some legs. But a skeptic would say that for just that reason, it looks like it's just an attempt by the Jews to cash in on their long-cherished national pride and hope. They figured this is the right time. So they made up the story. Maybe they even faked some events there, but with the complicity of all the Jewish leaders, that wouldn't be hard. And there it goes. But that's not what happened. And that explanation can't get any traction with the actual way things happened, because the way things actually happened, it wasn't with the help and support of the entire Jewish leadership. It was in the teeth of a very large percentage of them, although some were persuaded, right? Nicodemus, what does John say about him? He was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, for fear of the Jews. Right, he's a Jewish leader, maybe a member of the Sanhedrin, but he's afraid. So he's a secret follower. And yet, some of them did follow him. In spite of religious and national prejudice, they followed him. It's not a wonder to me that we don't have more of the Jewish nation converted. It's a wonder to me that we have any of them who accepted him. Because was he the Messiah they were looking for?
No.
What were they looking for? From Mary's Magnificat in Luke 1 to the question of the disciples in Acts 1, just before the ascension, what are they looking for? Lord, will you restore the kingdom to Israel at this time? They want a king. And they want a king the way that the Jews wanted a king when they were tired of judges. They wanted a king who would break the yoke of Rome. And they thought that was what they were going to get. One of the most pathetic little stories in the Gospels is the time that James and John come with their mother, and Mama, Jewish Mama, Once to ask Jesus for a favor. Can my son sit one at your right hand and one at your left hand when you come into your kingdom? You think she's thinking a spiritual kingdom? I don't think so. Jewish mama is not interested in a spiritual kingdom. Jewish mama wants kingdom. And so he wasn't the picture of what they were looking for. Oh, there's prophecy that does fit him. We can talk about that. When I want to talk about messianic prophecy, I just go straight to Isaiah 53 and start reading. You can try this. Try this as an experiment if you've got a non-Christian friend who's willing to listen. Just say, I'm going to read a passage of the Bible to you. I want you to tell me who this is. Read Isaiah 53. Easy! That's Jesus! St. Augustine says, beautiful line, the Jews are our librarians. They will stand surety for the fact that these books are not Christian inventions. wherever you date the writing of Isaiah. Personally, I think there was one Isaiah, but I know a lot of people think there were two or three or half a dozen Isaiahs. Doesn't matter. Push it down to the year 500. Doesn't matter. That's 500 B.C. And then read Isaiah 53 and see all the things that happen in it. See things that happen that look completely incomprehensible. He's killed, and yet, how does that passage proceed? He's killed, he's put in a grave. Remember, this is not a Christian work. It's part of our possession now. It's not authored by Christians. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. With his stripes we are healed. He was oppressed. He was afflicted. He opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people, and they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. He's dead. We get that. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Wait, he's dead. What's all this stuff? Is that somebody else? No, it's that I'm just reading down through the passage. What a baffling passage to try to interpret. You're a devout Jew. You're reading your holy books. You come across this passage in Isaiah. The Targum of Jonathan says, back in chapter 52, where the whole thing really begins, "Behold, my servant the Messiah shall deal prudently." It's expressly taken to be messianic by the Jews, not just by some Christians reading back later through Christian lenses. It's taken that way by the Jews. So what's going on with that? Some of the Jewish interpreters were so puzzled by that, they said, you know, weird though this sounds, there must be two messiahs. The Mashiach ben David, the Messiah, the son of David. He's the guy who's going to be on the throne. And I am not making this up. Mashiach ben Yosef, the Messiah, the son of Joseph, he will be suffering somehow. There will be something sorrowful, kind of like Jeremiah, about him. There's literally, in the Jewish literature, a discussion of the possibility, the interpretation that there are two messiahs, not one. Those are the lengths they were driven to try to reconcile their own scriptures. What do you think? Jesus have a kingdom? Less than 300 years after Jesus' crucifixion, the emperor of Rome knelt and confessed himself a believer in a crucified peasant of his own domain. Rome. It's like Vladimir Putin becoming a Mennonite. you have to wrap your mind around this. Absolutely astonishing. I've been throwing out questions. I have more, but I bet you do too. Maybe a question you've heard somebody toss out, maybe a question that you've rolled around in your mind, maybe somebody closer to you than just internet acquaintance has raised some questions to you, and you're wondering, where are some resources for answering those? So instead of my picking and choosing, give you a chance, if you got any that you've heard. Somebody does already. Yay! Points to you. Go ahead.
So my brother is an atheist, and so he used to always tease me in talking about the verses where it talks about women should be silent and women should not talk over men. So
right.
Those were his favorite books in the Bible, and I really, verses, and I could never really
give a good answer
right,
as to
so,
why it says
so what do we do with the passages, especially some of the passages in the Pauline epistles, where Paul says some things that seem pretty odd about women not talking in the churches, right? She got questions, let her ask her husband afterward. What's all that about? Where do you think it would make sense to go even to try to begin to figure out what's going on with stuff like that? And the answer here, for once, is not simply, I don't know, but I'll say old books. That's not where I'm going. It's almost always where I'm going, but not this time. What kind of information would you think it would be helpful to have to try to address those kinds of questions?
I mean, like, what was going on in that time, and what kind of church he was running?
Yeah, what's exactly? We want to know, in that case, about the cultural context behind statements like that. Have you ever been to a mosque?
Cool.
If you ever do visit one during worship, you'll see immediately some of the differences between that and church as we would do it today. For one thing, all the women will be on one side, all the men will be on another, and there will be a little lattice work dividing the mosque. Okay, so you'll be off in one part, women folk one place, men the other place. That was actually not uncommon in synagogues. Women go in the one place, the men go in the other. Now, although some women in Judaism obtained an education, it was not common for them to obtain an education in Torah. In fact, we have in the Talmud records of utterances of pious rabbis saying, better to burn the Torah than to teach it to a woman. Feminist of the year? Maybe not. These guys were pretty fanatical about not teaching these things to women, also about not talking to women. Again, another Talmudic reference. A man should not speak to a woman out in the street. No, not to his own wife. Honey, where'd you put the car keys? Whoa, no. Wow, you can't even talk to your own wife? No. So, what's that a recipe for? You divide the synagogue. On the one side, you put all the little boys. I used to teach at yeshiva, all right? They were many things, but one of them was pretty studious about studying their Torah and Talmud. I'd have them come to me, sir, I promised that I'd do an extra bit of Torah study in honor of the death of Avadya's aunt. Is it okay if I go early? You know, he might be lying to me, but I'd probably say, okay, Shmuley, just go ahead and do it. But on the one side, you got all the people who are actually doing some study of this. Can't, oh man, walk down memory lane. They came to me with a little problem from Torah, and I gave an answer. I said, "That's just what Rashi said." So, okay, Rashi's my friend. And on the other side of the lattice work, you've got people who have systematically not been trained in this stuff, and they're sitting there, they're listening to all this stuff going on up front. Yeah. It's baffling. It's boring. You think maybe they go, "What's he talking about?" You're going to start asking questions. One possibility, I'm not going to be dogmatic about this, is that the dynamic from Judaism spilled over into the churches, and again, you had some bifurcation with some of the people just not being as well instructed as others. That wasn't Paul's idea, right? Paul hung out with Priscilla and Aquila. Paul actually gave them enough training, obviously, that they could go and they could instruct Apollos when he didn't really know quite everything that he needed to know. So it's not like Paul was opposed to teaching women at all, but if there's a disturbance arising in the service, let's not have that. That could be distracting to everybody. Heck, it can be distracting to you if you're singing songs and the person behind you has a very loud, very off-key voice. Or is one of those people who thinks that the way to unwrap that piece of hard candy so that no one will notice
is to do it very slowly.
Where do people get these ideas? I don't know. So there's one possibility. We know certain things about the society that would have created an odd asymmetry, and we know that the early churches were largely populated with people who come from Judaism. So there's a possible source. For more insight on this, one place I would suggest that you go is a book that I actually advise you to just buy. Craig Keener, K-E-E-N-E-R. Bible Background Commentary for the New Testament. Every passage of every book gets expounded with lots of insight from the cultural context. If you want more, you can go and get some books by Malina and Rohrbaugh from the Context Group, who are really big into explaining some of these things, again, by bringing in lots of insights of cultural context. So that would be the direction that I would go for it, much as it pains me to say that it's not an old book. It's a good book.
I'd like to add one more thing, too, on cultural context. This is when you can't get to a resource and you don't have the answer. Because there's a lot of assumptions going on in these kinds of questions that people can understand the truth about culture back then, and that they know why Paul said that, and Paul was therefore a bad person. And this comes from David T. Lamb in his book, God Behaving Badly, and he's talking about the Old Testament, but it works for the New Testament. Ask the person to imagine moving themselves forward in time 2,000 years and being the archaeologist who discovers a church bulletin with advice to men: do not read Sports Illustrated in March. Now, that would be utterly baffling to you unless you knew that in March, I think it's March, I don't actually have direct knowledge of this, that's the annual swimsuit issue. But without that piece of information, you might think that the Christians were anti-Marchites.
Yeah, Tom, I'm pretty sure that's it. I'm pretty sure it was just a thing about March.
Well, yeah. The point is that as confused as that person would be about the 21st century, you have the possibility of being that clueless about 2,000 years ago, too. And you ought to at least wait until you find out and not draw conclusions without knowing.
Oh, wait, Colleen, I'm sorry. Just hold on a second. You had yours up first.
Oh, mine's kind of a longer.
Oh, okay. Do you have a shorter one?
I
don't know.
I'll try to be. I was just thinking, because since you have given example of Islam's women's praying separately, but and the women also pray, if husband and wife, they're praying even home, she stands behind.
Right,
and
right.
And there's a reason.
Yeah.
I'm trying to bring it back to this questions that was asked. And there was a reason, because they were a distraction. Their prayers may be hindered because a woman is considered as a sexual object within Islam. Now, coming back to, there was a reason women were separated.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any reason within the Jewish culture or any spiritual reason why Paul said it?
That's a great question. And the honest answer for me to give to you right now is I don't have such a reason at the tip of my tongue. So that would be a place to just to go and to try to see if we could find it.
But there was segregation in the temple.
There was. Oh, yeah. That we know that they did it.
If you look at it in reality, Islam is a form of Judaism.
It has many similarities in those respects, yes.
Or ceremony and laws, everything is there. So there was a reason. There could have been some reason within, because the culture always affects.
And maybe the distraction reason was part of it. There was a group of Pharisees who were called the Bleeding Pharisees. Again, this is not a Saturday Night Live sketch. I can't make this up. Okay, they were called the Bleeding Pharisees because they were wandering around closing their eyes all the time so that they wouldn't by accident look at a woman. And what happens when you're walking around with your eyes closed is that you run into things a lot. And so the idea was, just because They didn't want to run the risk of seeing a woman. They run into stuff. So the bleeding Pharisees were a notorious little group. I'm not creative and clever enough to have made that up. That's real. Did you have something real quick?
Yeah, well, I don't know how quick, but my problem with your issue with the context of this thing about women is we believe in an inerrant Bible. So what do you do with inerrancy?
Right. That? The Bible is written for us, but it was not written to us. In order to understand it, we have to understand it as it was meant to be understood to those to whom it was first written. That doesn't mean that it doesn't pertain to us. That doesn't mean it's not relevant to us. But we do need to understand what was going on that made these things be written for these purposes. And sometimes that's hard. Fortunately, the things that are really essential are very clear. There's not any doubt about whether you need to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ in order to be saved. The answer is yes. That's clear. That's unanimous. There's no digging around in cultural context that we need to do to figure that out. For some things that are far more peripheral, it sometimes does take some thought. I'll bring up more examples, again, of they're relatively peripheral things, but they're things people fasten onto if they look like a handle that can be used for assailing Christianity. And I'm not disputing what you're saying, but sometimes we still need to do a little bit of our homework in order to get back to the mindset so that I can understand this as one of Paul's intended readers would have understood it. I'm not there. It's in a different culture, in a different language. That's not an impossible barrier. It's the glory of God to conceal a thing, says one of the Proverbs, but the glory of kings is to find it out. Colleen.
So it's related to kind of both of those questions.
Sure.
A conversation I've kind of witnessed or heard a rant about is, as the Christian habit of, like, picking and choosing, it's used a lot with homosexuality and the woman thing, but also some other stuff. So they'll say, you just said to me that woman covering her head and not talking to church doesn't apply because it only applied to that church he was speaking to at that time. But then you'll say, when Paul forbids homosexual behaviors or something else, that it applies to us currently. So how do you pick which one applies then and which one is more like time?
Right, so how do you determine scope on something like that? If you're going to bring in context, Where does that stop? Is it a genie out of a bottle kind of problem where now that I've done that, maybe everything goes relativized?
Yeah,
and that's not at all what I want to endorse, but I understand the objection there.
You're not going to get accused of picking it.
Right. Let me spin it around at first and ask this question. Supposing, for the sake of the argument, that as some people actually believe, women really should have their head covered in church. Suppose that that were actually, and you know, many of us who don't think so, were just wrong about that. That would be a possibility, right? It's not one I happen to endorse, but it is a possibility. I could just be wrong, okay? Not all things that are wrong are equally wrong. All sin is an offense to God, but some sins God says are worse than others. Right? You're reading in, say, Ezekiel, and you come across a passage that says, Son of man, do you see this? Come, I will show you something even more detestable than this. There's orders of these things. There are worse things. Uniformly, throughout Scripture, homosexual behavior is condemned in the strongest terms. This is not a matter where there's really any room for relativizing it, unless you want to go the Matthew Vines route, which, frankly, looks like an amazing piece of special pleading. So I would say, you know, first of all, step back and say, supposing that I was wrong about that, would, you know, well, obviously if I'm wrong, I should change my behavior, but how grave is the issue here? And then I'd say do your cultural homework on that, and you'll find some things about, you know, the head coverings, the long hair. Male prostitutes in Corinth wore their hair long. It's a kind of an advertising sign. Okay? It's a shame for a man to have long hair. Why? Because long hair is intrinsically evil? No. It's sending a signal in the cultural context. It's intended to. You don't mess with that. Right? If you're not intending to send certain signals about your sexual preferences, and you're a guy, you do not wear an earring in your right ear. You just don't do that. Or you don't have any friends to tell you any better. Myself, I kind of like to keep my earlobes intact, so I don't do any of this stuff. But there are certain things that have been co-opted. They send certain signals. Intrinsically, we're not Gnostics. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with a piece of hardware in your ear. Okay? But there are cultural signals that are sent. I like rainbows. I'm fond of them. I'm not going to buy a little sticker of one and put it on my bumper. Right. There's nothing wrong with a rainbow, but it's going to send a signal. And so I think one of the ways then of approaching this on a more direct level is to look into things like that. And just come back with explicit information on the context. And if you don't have that, right? As Tom said, what do? When you don't have a resource ready to hand, say, I don't know, but I'll look into it.
But also remind them that they don't know either and that they shouldn't be drawing conclusions.
Which is where the Sports Illustrated example is a great one.
Yeah.
I think it's a part of the culture. Even in my culture, even when people go to church, they look. My wife is here for the last so many years.
Yeah.
When we pray, the first thing she does, she wants to make sure her head is covered. It's part of the culture.
Yeah.
So I can't say that you're in America, don't cover your head.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't try to wrest that away from her either.
So in people that go to churches, you mm-hmm. go to the Middle East, you go to any of those countries, still we sit separately.
Yeah.
We have a head covering.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure the women's, the moment you are entering the church, the head is covered.
Yeah. Tom, I think we're about up, but before you take over...